an interesting night tonight. Have a good show, my friend.
Thank you, Willem.
So yes, breaking news tonight. I am in for Ashley Banfield, and we start on a very sad note. One of Jeffrey Epstein's most prominent accusers, Virginia Giuffre, has died. According to her family, this survivor of Jeffrey Epstein has died by suicide. And her family released a statement which reads, "It is with utterly broken hearts that we announce that Virginia passed away last night at her farm in Western Australia. She lost her life to suicide after being a lifelong victim of sexual abuse and sex trafficking. Virginia was a fierce warrior in the fight against sexual abuse and sex trafficking. She was the light that lifted so many survivors. In the end, the toll of abuse is so heavy that it became unbearable for Virginia to handle its weight." And it's interesting when you think about that statement, the circumstances surrounding her death. We're just taking that statement for what it is. We're still going to piece together exactly what might have happened here. But what we do know is that the 41-year-old died in Yirrkabi, Australia, where she had apparently been living for several years. As we've been talking about, she's one of the earliest, most outspoken accusers, not only of Jeffrey Epstein, but other high-profile individuals like Prince Andrew filed a lawsuit against him. Her survivor, but most survivors, again, they give credit to Virginia Giuffre for the strength to speak out. And as we know, she was famously seen in this photo with Prince Andrew, his hand around her. Ghislaine Maxwell, look at her in the background. And I mentioned this before, I want to say it again, but when you think about the work that Virginia Giuffre did, she founded SOAR, Speak Out, Act, Reclaim. This is an organization whose sole purpose is to help the survivors of sexual abuse. I want to bring in right now Josh Schiffer. He's an attorney whose firm represents some of the Epstein victims. Josh, thanks for coming on. This is sad. Your initial reaction to this news, as we're still trying to piece together what exactly happened here, because she did have quite an impact on this conversation regarding Jeffrey Epstein and others.
Absolutely. The case wouldn't have existed without the input, her cooperation, her bravery at the beginning, inspiring so many other people to come forward. Remember, this is years and years in the making, and it wasn't all hidden behind the scenes. Like we think about, these were public prosecutions. These were issues talked about. These parties were attended by so many famous people. So it was really out in the open, but she inspired people to really come forward, and her loss will hopefully be a marker and almost an inspiration for people to calling attention to the epidemic that is sex trafficking, that is the international sex industry. This is an issue that still persists. It changes its form all the time, and it exists all around the world. This just happened to be a really prominent example of something that people are now seeing happens all the time.
There was something very strange that happened just a few days ago, though. So she posted on Instagram that she'd been hit by a bus, that she only had a few days to live, and many online accused her of not telling the truth. Even Prince Andrew weighed in. That's a weird thing to happen right before she dies, apparently by suicide, right?
It's a very challenging final note. She was involved in this vehicle wreck. She then was very public about the fact that she was given 4 days to live. And needless to say, that didn't transpire. And there's a lot of questions about the injuries, how they happened, what happened exactly. She was released from the hospital. There was a lot of coverage in Australia about her. She's got a little bit more celebrity down there necessarily than here in the United States and the West. So really, they were following up. And just 1 week later, or 2 weeks later, this happening. We don't have details about exactly the cause of death. There's just this statement that's been made by the family. I'm sure people are scratching their heads and asking questions just because of the associations that she had. And it's clear she suffered a lot of trauma. She had not just suffered at the hands of Jeffrey Epstein, but she'd also been a voice and a victim for other domestic violence issues. And that's really the lasting message that I hope people carry away from this tragedy, is that domestic violence, it doesn't just stop. It's something that can sit with you, and your victimization can last for years. Post-traumatic stress disorder is very real, and we're realizing that with tragedies like this.
There was one word in that statement from the family that I think resonates, and you just hit upon it: lifelong. And that idea of what accusers and sexual assault survivors go through, it's a real consequence. And again, we're still just reacting to this breaking news. We're trying to piece it together. We're trying to piece together what we can make from this statement. But unfortunately, as we heard, I was talking with Leland Vittert about it just a moment ago, this is just going to spiral into a lot of different theories, a lot of different conspiracy theories, and this is going to reignite the conversation, maybe in some good ways and maybe in some bad ways. And I'll give you the final thought on that, Josh.
Yeah, let's just hope for the best. When we have a loss like this, when there's something that's so big, let's hope that it serves for some good.
Joshua Schiffer, thank you so much for taking the time. Appreciate it.
Thank you, sir. Have a great night.
Thank you. Now we're going to switch gears, okay? Because here's the thing. If you were strolling through Lower Manhattan today, big day, Foley Square in particular, around the U.S. District Courthouse, you might have wondered, what kind of block party did you just wander into? Italian music was blasting, the sidewalks were swarming with people holding signs, maybe wearing costumes. If you don't believe me, take a look. You see what I'm talking about? Yep, soon enough you figure out this was no street festival. No, it was the latest display of, dare I say, hero worship for the murder suspect being arraigned on federal charges inside. The suspect's name, as if you didn't already know, Luigi Mangione. He's not a rock star. He's accused of being a cold-blooded murderer. And while we've seen the Free Luigi forces before, this time a few counter-protesters actually came out, and they too understood the assignment. One brought his own private security and set up a skeleton dressed like the video game character in a makeshift electric chair. Can't make this stuff up. This was outside, okay? And inside the court, it was standing room only. And again, among the spectators for at least the second time at a Mangione hearing, you know who was there? Chelsea Manning, a former U.S. Army analyst who went to prison for leaking secrets. Reporters asked Manning afterward whether she's a Luigi supporter, and she said she merely supports, and I quote, the justice system being done in a fair manner. Now, the subject of all this attention arrived in a prison jumpsuit, shackled at the wrists and ankles. You'll have to take my word for it, because cameras aren't allowed in federal courts. Reporters who were there say that he seemed calm, even winked at somebody in the gallery. When it came time for business, he pleaded not guilty to all four federal charges against him. Murder through use of a firearm, two counts of stalking, and a firearms offense. Luigi also faces charges at the state level too, of course, for what the U.S. Attorney General calls the cold-blooded assassination of UnitedHealthcare CEO Brian Thompson on a New York sidewalk back in December. But New York doesn't have the death penalty, so the feds do, and they want Luigi to get it. And the defense, not surprisingly, wants death taken off the table, in part because of inflammatory comments that were arguably made, like the one I just read, from senior government officials. Now, I'm going to stop here and turn things over to News Nation senior correspondent Laura Engel, my friend, who was there to learn a little bit more.
Jesse, two very different vibes here at federal court today. We had this spring-like concert going on outside with Luigi Mangione's supporters singing and chanting, holding up big, bright-colored signs. But inside is where the real life-and-death battle began. Luigi Mangione entered court in a mustard-colored jail suit, hands and feet shackled, uncuffed when seated, and he leaned into the microphone and said, not guilty. His supporters were also inside the gallery, and reaction was audible when he entered court. Our producer hearing gasps and comments like, this is unreal, and he is so expletive hot. One woman was seen covering her mouth, smiling and staring throughout the whole entire proceedings. Also new today, the defense revealed state prosecutors accessed privileged attorney calls. Calls between Mangione and his attorney, Karen Agnifilo, and that they were inadvertently shared. The judge ordered a letter be handed in by May 2nd, confirming private call access is protected by both sides. A Judge Garnett also issued a public statement warning under Rule 23.1, ordered no public commentary could impact a fair trial. And that was directed at the SDNY's Jay Clayton and asked that he pass it on to Attorney General Pam Bondi. Discovery was also addressed here, and the discovery in this case is massive. 2 terabytes of data. It includes FBI files, phone records, social media, Google, and DA materials. The government must turn it all over by May 27th. The Department of Justice also filed notice of intent to seek the death penalty on April 24th, and the defense called Bondi's announcement political and a stunt. The defense motion to challenge the death penalty is now due on June 27th. No trial date has been set in the state case, just suppression hearings for now. Then the defense wants the federal trial to go first because of capital charges. The next federal court hearing will happen on December 5th, and at that time, the judge hopes to set a trial date for the following year. Jesse?
Laura Ingle, one of the best in the business, and I'm also joined by one of the other best in the business, Mark Garagos, criminal defense attorney, co-host of the two-hit podcast, Reasonable Doubt and Two Angry Men. Thank you so much for taking the time, Mark. It's good to see you. So tell me if am I crazy when I look at all the fanfare? Is it crazy for me to say, I don't know, I'm shocked he was actually once again indicted on criminal charges? I mean, since with all the support that Mangione is getting, over $900,000 in the Luigi Defense Fund, last time I checked, is it outside the realm of possibility that despite what is a low standard to return an indictment and the plethora of evidence, the grand jurors might just say, hey, you know what, let's let him off? I mean, I really thought that he might not even be indicted because of the support he's getting.
Well, it's an interesting question. In doing this for over 40 years, I can tell you that I probably had less than a handful of no true bills, which is what the grand jury does if they don't bring an indictment. It's extremely rare. This might have been one of those cases. But at the end of the day, I think that the prosecution has got the heavier lift. I think the cynic in me says one of the reasons they want to bring a death penalty is traditionally and based on the sociological evidence, death penalty qualified juries and jurors are more pro-prosecution and more law and order. So that kind of weeds out, if you will, those who may be supportive or at least give this young man a presumption of innocence, because as you can see, it's a highly polarizing case.
Talking about the death penalty for a second, do you think that it should be on the table? Because I listened to some of the defense's arguments. I read through their filings, and I gotta say, I think they make some pretty good arguments. The idea that this is not a traditional death penalty case at the federal level. It's not as if he's accused of murdering multiple people or part of a terrorist organization or a criminal organization. You have a pending state case, so you would argue it might be duplicative. They argued it's politically motivated. It's all based on the president's executive agenda rather than following the law on death penalty, and that this decision to move forward on the death penalty is arbitrary. Do you think, but look, I also say from the other point of view, I understand why they're going forward with the death penalty. Look at the reaction, look at the crime that he's accused of committing, but do you think it's the right move to go forward with the death penalty here?
You know, it's a policy move, number one, as you indicated, and I thought that full disclosure, my daughter is at the firm that is defending him, and I've read their motion. I think it's compelling, as you just indicated. But to the prosecution, I would counsel, be careful what you wish for. You already have somebody who has kind of a cult hero status. Going after the death penalty in a case like this just increases the amount of martyrdom. It also kind of puts in stark relief, why is this particular crime, as you just detailed it, why is that worthy of the death penalty, especially against the backdrop for the last couple of decades of all of the kind of misplaced death penalty prosecutions where you've got people, due to the great work of the Innocence Project, kind of sprung from death row due to problems in the proof and problems in the prosecution. So I don't think it's a wise move from a policy standpoint, and I think from a legal standpoint, it probably is not the right move either.
Talking from a legal standpoint, just focusing on the federal charges, because I could talk forever about the state charges and whether or not it's really a murder committed in furtherance of terrorism. Put that to the side. The federal charges he's facing, stalking, murder through use of a firearm, which is basically murder during the commission of stalking. So those are the appropriate charges, or do you think he might be overcharged here?
Yeah, one of the interesting things is, and you alluded to it, the difference between the state theory and the federal theory. You've got the stalking on the one hand, and you've got the state theory, which to some observers and legal analysts that I've talked to, you can make a pretty persuasive argument that the two theories are at odds with each other. Now, there's nothing that says a prosecutor can't talk out of both sides of their mouth, but here you have two different prosecutorial agencies. Namely, you've got a state prosecutor and you've got the federal Department of Justice, and they're taking positions that basically are irreconcilable when you look at it. So it's an interesting intellectual dance that's being occurring here between the feds and the state.
Well, one thing that I was told by a great attorney, Serena Townsend, she actually said if it's murder through use of a firearm and it's murder during the course of stalking, and you look at the stalking charge, Brian Thompson would have had to be in reasonable fear for his life, but wouldn't that mean that he had to know that he was being stalked? And I paused and I said, that seems like a good point. Is if they have to prove that Thompson knew he was being stalked, that doesn't fit.
Right, and that's what I'm saying. There,
yeah.
That's the tension between the two theories. You can't reconcile the two theories here, and that's one of the problems that you've got. And I think it's been highlighted by Karen Agnifilo, who is the lead defense lawyer, in some of the arguments that she's made in court and in the paperwork. And she and Jacob Kaplan, I think, are going to hit hard on that.
Mark, let me ask you about this. The defense saying that prosecutors access privileged attorney-client calls, that seems like a big deal. And the judge was kind of asking questions about that.
You know, this seems to happen. As I sit here in New York and I see case after case, there seems to be, and by the way, it's happened with specifically under a different administration. It's happened under this administration. But there seems to be this recurring theme of intruding into attorney-client communications by the Department of Justice. Part of the reason that I think this constantly happens is the Department of Justice, for the most part, still adheres to this idea that they've got what they call a trial team and a filter team, meaning the filter team are still Department of Justice lawyers, but they're the ones who are going to look at stuff and they're going to filter out what the other trial lawyers or case team is supposed to see. It's really kind of an anachronistic system. In California, for instance, there's a more robust system where they have what they call a special master, and you have a lawyer that is not part of the prosecutorial team. They're listed on a panel. They get appointed by the judge. Nobody gets to see anything until the defense lawyer goes in and he first goes through everything. He's the first eyes on it. He's the one who asserts privilege. And then the judge gets to see it and make that decision. Well, that's a much more robust protection.
That became a huge issue in the Combs case. And if we had more time, I would talk about that. But Mark, before I let you go, I just wanted to get your thoughts real quick on the breaking news that we had at the top of the show. The death of Virginia Giuffre, a central figure in the Epstein case. Your thoughts about that?
Well, I mean, anytime somebody loses their life at too young, it's a tragedy. I will tell you, though, that the unintended consequence, I think, of this is it would be shocking to me if the defense in the Sean Combs case, full disclosure, I've represented Sean for years, it would be shocking to me if they went forward with jury selection on Monday. How in the world could the lead accuser in the lead previous sex slave case in the Southern District of New York, how could the lead accuser commit suicide on the Friday night before Monday when they're calling in all the jurors for another prominent man who's being charged with sex slave in the exact same district? I just don't see how they can go forward on Monday. I think you'll see either tonight or tomorrow the defense team weigh in and say, hey, wait, time out. You can't go forward on this.
Can you just amplify that real quick? I mean, what would the reasoning be?
Well, the reasoning is, remember, Jeffrey Epstein, who was the last prominent person in the Southern District of New York, who was found dead by suicide in this district, in this jail, or in the, not in the same jail, but His lead accuser now dies by suicide, the lead accuser against him, literally 60 hours before hundreds of jurors are being called in on another kind of wall-to-wall coverage, what I always call a supersized case for jury selection. To me, I just don't know how in the world. I think that this news, as we're sitting here on a Friday evening, is just breaking. My guess is that it's going to gain a lot of momentum through the weekend, right up until Monday morning when they have jurors showing up into the Southern District asked to be talking about a sex slave charge.
Doesn't it start May 5th, though, or am I wrong?
No, you're wrong. The jurors come in next Monday.
Okay, interesting. Okay, we'll see what happens. Mark Garagos, good seeing you. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk about two topics tonight. Appreciate it.
Good to see you too. Thank you.
All right, coming up. There's only so much you can learn about a case in a courtroom. It's just a fact. Sometimes you have to pile onto a bus and go to the crime scene yourself. It doesn't happen in every trial, but it happened in the first murder trial of Karen Reed. And guess what? Today it happened again. We're going to get the lowdown from a reporter who is there when we come back. That you're supposed to be fascinated by, but really clearly aren't. Oh, I guess you had to be there, right? Remember that? Guess you had to be there. And you know what? They're right. Being there definitely makes all the difference in the world. So it is a shame it happens so rarely in trials, even murder trials. But you know what? It's now happened twice in Karen Reed's trials for allegedly killing her police officer boyfriend, John O'Keefe. Just like the jury in her first trial, jurors in the Reed trial paid a visit to 34 Fairview Road in Canton, Massachusetts. That is where Reed dropped her boyfriend off after a day of bickering over text and a night of drinking, and it is where John O'Keefe died. Now, how he died, the cause of death, all very interesting questions. Allegedly, prosecutors say, after being hit by Reed's Lexus. But jurors examined the distance from the spot where O'Keefe's body was found to the house where his cop buddies were partying that night. They also saw the alleged murder weapon with a busted taillight. The lawyers were there too, of course, defense, prosecution. But even though Reed herself had gotten permission to go, she declined, saying, "I don't ever want to go back to 34 Fairview," she said. And look, I can't blame her. I'm joined right now, though, by Flint McColgan, police and courts reporter for the Boston Herald, who did make the trip today, paid very close attention. Thanks so much for joining us, Flint. So you went to 34 Fairview 2. Where exactly, though, where was the press located? And I guess what could or couldn't you see?
So it was the same situation as last year in the first trial. We were at a cross street, and there was like half a very long, you know, suburban block away. So I couldn't quite see the faces of the jurors, but, I could see the lawyers pointing out things that they wanted jurors to pay attention to. And hopefully that was helpful to the jurors. We'll see how it goes.
What was your takeaway? I mean, I guess one of the big takeaways is, what should we be thinking about, if you can tell us, the distance from where John O'Keefe's body was found to maybe the front door, maybe the distance to the house? Because there's two different theories here, right? He was either hit by Karen Reed's SUV, or he went into the house, was beat up, and then left to die outside. What is the distance from the body to the front door?
It is a sizable front yard. It's well above average in my experience of suburban front yards. And I don't know exactly how many feet or something, but it is off to the very edge of the property line. So it's quite a distance. If you're looking in that photo there, I mean, those people milling about, they're still really far. So it's quite a distance. But where he was found was very close to the roadway over where that flagpole is and the fire hydrant there. And it's quite a distance from the front door.
So in other words, that seems to help the prosecution?
It could. Certainly, when you see how close it is to the roadway. But if you are going to take the defense's theory that there was a cover-up and they wanted to make it look that way, obviously right. You would put it as close to the road as possible. So it's a give or take, really, on that.
It washes itself out.
Yeah.
Okay, let me ask you about this, though. The jury heard about Karen's blood alcohol content today.
Yes.
The defense pushed hard that the test used is mm-hmm. different from the forensic test that was used in a court of law. Let's play a little bit of that, actually.
You testified earlier today that your lab is accredited by CAP, which is the College of American Pathologists. Do you recall that testimony?
Yes, I do.
But CAP is a clinical laboratory accreditation, not a forensic accreditation, right?
We don't have the forensic accreditation for Good Samaritan.
In fact, Good Samaritan has never been investigated or accredited by any forensic accreditation team to ensure that you perform all of your tests with the integrity necessary to support results in court, right?
We've never had the forensic accreditation, but we have very good quality lab results, which I could go into further.
But you've never been accredited by a forensic accreditation team, right?
No.
What do you think the jury took away from that?
So that testimony was quite interesting in that it wasn't very interesting, other than the takeaway of that, you know, even hours after she allegedly killed John O'Keefe, you know, her blood alcohol was above what's the legal limit, you know, and that's even hours of sobering up afterwards. But the weird thing about it is, like, is how nearly underplayed that was. There, we had a very long lecturing about the process and the chemistry of about how you do blood extractions, and I could see, you know, the jurors looking back and forth, their eyes were getting, you know, a little heavy, I believe. So, and it wasn't till the end, and then Adam Lally, who was questioning that witness, was just, what were the results? And then he quit questioning, and it was just like, it just didn't really seem to land. It probably took a few seconds for people to realize, oh, well, he just gave some important information there.
Was the jury paying attention to the last witness of the day called by the prosecution, this firefighter, this paramedic who rode with Karen Reed to the hospital? What did he have to say?
Yeah, it would be very hard for them not to pay attention to that because it was testy between the lawyers. I don't think I can remember, at least so far in this trial, maybe the last one is different, but so far in this trial, I haven't seen that many objections. There were four different sidebars to discuss the parameters of what he was allowed to talk about. And it all came down to this. The prosecution really wants the jurors to believe that a statement that Karen Reed made in the ambulance as she was being taken for a psych evaluation after John O'Keefe had already been transported, she had said that according to this witness, that she was really worried because the last words, her last words, specifically that phrase, to John O'Keefe were ones of anger. And so the prosecution.
Okay. I say, all right, I get it. I get where they're going. Yeah. I get it. Mm-hmm. You know, the idea of tumultuous relationship, incentive to harm him. I get it. All right, Flint McColligan, thanks so much for taking the time. Appreciate it.
Yep. Okay. Thank you.
You got it. All right. Now, believe it or not, I can hardly believe it. We're just, 10 days away from jury selection in the Diddy trial? Though, according to Mark Garagos, it's like next week. It's like Monday. But anyway, today, some unfinished business that got dealt with in a way the prosecution is no doubt celebrating. We learned that Diddy could have ended this trial before it starts, but chose not to. Does he know something we and the feds don't? Stick around. That story's next. Sex parties known as freak-offs, there is no such thing as a routine hearing. And we got more proof of that today. Just a week and a half before the scheduled start of jury selection, well, maybe starting Monday, we're not entirely sure now, in Diddy's sex crimes trial in federal court out in New York, the judge ruled on that infamous hotel security video of Combs chasing his then-girlfriend, Cassie Ventura, down a hallway where he purportedly viciously beat her and dragged her back to his room in 2016. The defense wanted to keep that video light years away from the jury, but the judge today sided with the prosecution, saying it shouldn't result in unduly unfair prejudice to Diddy. And prosecutors also let it slip today that apparently Diddy really does think he's going to be acquitted. Why? He said that to his fans again and again, but today it came out that he was offered a plea deal and rejected it. Now, we don't know what was in this deal, but the judge says He'll address it in court next week. The defense did pick up a partial win, though, today. The judge ruled that neither prosecutors nor their expert witnesses can use the term coercive control when discussing how Combs allegedly treated his accusers. There is a lot to unpack here. So I'm really glad my friend and prominent trial attorney Dante Mills is here with me now to talk more about this. Dante, good to see you. Let's start with the plea deal. Don't know exactly what it is. You actually believe that it's not necessarily off the table yet? He might take a deal?
It's never off the table. And I handle a lot of cases, and that first deal, very rarely do you take. I think that's the start of the process. I know that it's going to have to be something where that he's not going to spend a substantial time in jail talking about 10 years or anything like that. Why would you take that? You would rather go to trial and see what the end result is. But if they can offer him something where it's in that five-year range and there's an understanding that he'll be cleared of everything else, it's going to be appealing to him.
Well, here's the thing, right? He wanted to go to trial as quickly as possible. He thinks he has the good...
Except for the fact
that... So you think because that tape is coming in, it changes the whole game?
I think that tape absolutely changes the whole game. Listen, I know we're having a talk here. Let's just break it down. Sean Combs, Diddy, was a hero to a lot of people. He was a guy who worked, pulled himself up by his bootstraps. He was known as a hard worker, but he worked hard and he played hard. That was a part of his lifestyle. To a lot of people, they wanted to be that. But heroes don't beat women. And when you see someone hit a woman the way he did and treat her that way, that hero nostalgia goes away. So there's a lot of people that wouldn't have convicted him, just said, oh, he was enjoying his life with these parties. But now they're going to look at him differently.
But here's the counterargument. He's not charged with sexual assault. He's not charged
Absolutely.
With battery. He's charged with sex trafficking. Now, the prosecution will say he was running away from a room where there was a sex worker in there. He drags her back to the room. That's the allegation. But the defense will say this was a unfortunate domestic spat. They know they're going in there. You think everything changed today because of what's allowed in? I mean, they did get some wins today in terms of what
they did, but we do know the law and most everything is about controlling the narrative. And if this jury, despite what the actual charges are, if they don't like who's in front of them, then they're more likely to believe the charges against them. That's just a fact. I've experienced that. That's why when you go into any trial, you want to make the defendant, you want to bring out the good in them. So jurors look at them a certain way. People are not looking at Sean Combs the way they used to. That glamour, that polish is gone. So they're going to be more likely to accept that he's done other bad things.
I think he wanted everything in his power to get rid of the transportation to engage in prostitution charges, said they were racist charges, wanted to make sure the jury never considered him, because it seems to me those might be the easiest charges to actually convict him of. If he was actually transporting sex workers, hotel receipts, monetary receipts, travel receipts.
Yeah.
But do you think this prosecution has a slam dunk case with racketeering, criminal enterprise, sex trafficking?
No, I don't think the racketeering is really going to go that far, because he ran a successful business, right? And it was about much more than these freak-offs or sex parties. That was almost like a side impact or a side effect of everything else that was going on. So it's going to be hard for them to say he put this together for the purposes of committing that crime. He's not making a ton of money. He's not profiting or anything like that off of these freak-offs. He's more using that just for his nostalgia and his prestige.
Well, let's say people testify who worked for him and said, yeah, we recruited these women. Yeah, he promised them benefits. We paid certain people. We brought in sex workers. Some people, there was, you know, allegations of forced labor, kidnapping, drug distribution, these underlying crimes for racketeering. Real quick, thoughts on that?
Well, it's Diddy parties. People want it to be at Diddy parties. So that's what the defense is going to put forward. Listen, people wanted to be a part of this, and Diddy was generous, right? So he did that not because he had to, but he was a generous person. They wanted to be there anyway.
Real quick, the prosecution said that they wanted to discuss this medical procedure that one of Combs' victims underwent. We don't know really what that's about, but it was allegedly he's going to show the degree of control Combs had. What on earth is that about?
If it shows some force, then you have to look at the body part. Is it the vaginal area? Is it maybe the wrist if somebody was tied? So that's what you're going to be looking for, what body parts are impacted. If it shows some kind of force to the point that she needed some medical care, maybe a surgery, that's going to make people say, okay, clearly maybe they were doing something against people's will. But again, he was a hero. People wanted to be around him. It's going to be hard to do that outside of this tape showing him beating a woman.
They won this win today. This forensic psychologist, Dr. Dawn Hughes, is going to testify for the prosecution. She testified in the Johnny Depp Amber Heard trial. She can't talk about coercive control, basically because it conflicts with what the legal definition is. And the jurors, by the way, they don't necessarily need an expert for a lot of this, right?
They're going to piece together if someone was there voluntarily or not. And again, I keep going back to this tape, the tape with the beating. That's why it's so important. Without that, the people wanting to be around Diddy is what everybody is going to think. But when they see him putting his hands on a woman, they're going to think he could do that to anybody, including these people who were coming to the party. And that's why they were afraid in those situations.
All right. We will see which way it shakes up. Dante Mills, great to see you. Thanks for coming here on Friday night. Thank you. It'll definitely be interesting. We're going to cover it now. Sometimes a crime is so vile, all you can do is hope that the person being accused really did it. So at least he can't do it again. After a break, a story that fits that bill. A New York money man who police say lured, drugged, raped, tortured, and traumatized women in a high-rise house of horrors. Those details when we come back. Successful private equity and venture capital executive and a committed philanthropist. All of which may or may not be true, but that's certainly not what New York police and the Manhattan District Attorney are calling him tonight. No. The DA got Ryan Hemphill indicted on 116 counts related to an alleged spree of, quote, grotesque sexual violence against six women over a span of months. Allegedly, Hemphill met these women on pay-to-play websites and lured them to his Midtown apartment where the pay was in fake money and the play was nothing short of torture. Here's DA Alvin Bragg.
Each of these six women was subjected to hours of physical and sexual violence. The defendant, we allege, beat them, drugged them, and restrained them. He threatened them with firearms. He used a shock collar and a cattle prod intended for livestock.
But Bragg says shock collars and cattle prods were only the start. Allegedly, Hemphill persuaded some of his victims to tell him their past sexual traumas in graphic detail, and then he recreated them. The six women specified in the charging papers are from the only ones to pass through this alleged house of horrors. Investigators say surveillance cameras captured dozens, if not hundreds, of women, many of them naked and blindfolded. They say they also found bullets and high-capacity magazines in Hemphill's apartment, along with a large amount of heroin, cocaine, and fentanyl. Yes, counterfeit money. According to D.A. Bragg, Hemphill's most potent weapon of all might have been fear.
He told them that he had resources that made him untouchable, including purported deep connections in law enforcement and in organized crime. He impressed upon them that going to the authorities would be futile and that he would never be held accountable. He told them that no one would ever believe them.
Well, yesterday, Hemphill pleaded not guilty to charges including rape, predatory sexual assault, facilitating a sex offense with a controlled substance, and bribing witnesses. He's being held without bond. But here's the thing. Some of this might feel like deja vu. You know why? Because in 2015, Hemphill was charged with holding a knife to an ex-girlfriend's throat. He admitted at trial that he enjoyed choking the woman during sex, yet somehow he wound up acquitted. Disturbing, to say the least. And let me just end this by saying, if you or somebody you know is a victim of sexual assault, help is out there. Call the National Sexual Abuse Hotline at 1-800-656-HOPE. And still ahead tonight, if you ever dreamed of throwing the party to end all parties, do I have an opportunity for you? The infamous Fry Festival is suddenly for sale. Well, the name, anyway. Fire Festival, excuse me. And I'm not the only one asking. What's the catch? We'll try to find out next. Fraud and colossal disappointment. Guess what? Now it can be yours or mine. Guessing anybody with a Venmo account could snap up Fire Festival, whose formerly imprisoned creator has just put it up for sale. Interested? This is barely a week after announcing that Fire Fest 2, supposedly planned for Mexico, was being postponed. Billy McFarland up and announced it that he's out. Big shocker here. In a statement on Wednesday, McFarland said, and I quote, "We have decided the best way to accomplish our goals is to sell the Fyre Festival brand, including its trademarks, IP, digital assets, media reach, and cultural capital, to an operator that can fully realize its vision." I'd love to know what cultural capital means, but I've got a pretty good idea what McFarland's goals are. He's made it known that he owes more than $30 million in back taxes and restitution from the debacle that was Fyre Fest 1. And by debacle, I mean the supposedly posh accommodations where tents with dirt floors were there, the high-end cuisine of cheese sandwiches. So place your bets, folks. Bidding is now live on the Fyre Fest website. See if anybody buys it up. Now, before we wrap anything up on a different note, let me just go back to something. We were talking about the Combs case. It's hard to imagine that Sean Combs would take a deal since he has been pushing so adamantly for this trial to begin in May. You know how unlikely it is, how rare it is to have a trial at a federal level, actually go to trial within a year of being arrested? Doesn't happen. So you wonder what a deal might look like. I mean, at the very least, one of the charges is at least 10 years in prison. They're basically saying he's the head of a criminal enterprise, that he was sex trafficking multiple individuals. What do I mean by that? Using force, fraud, or coercion, drugs, force, threats to force people to engage in illegal commercial sex acts, transporting people across state lines for this purpose, operating a criminal enterprise that was engaged in alleged kidnapping, forced labor, arson, drug distribution, and yet they'll give him a slap on the wrist, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years. You got to wonder what that deal would look like. But as we talked about with Dante Mills, as this case progresses and this evidence goes forward and that video was played for the jury, will they decide it's time to take a deal? We'll wait and see. That does it for us tonight. I'm Jesse Weber. Thank you so much for watching.